Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and get started. First, I have to inform you, although I tried an email today, that you have been victims of a devious bait and switch. I'm teaching Physics 102. Sometimes I teach Physics 100. Physics 100 is a course that is entitled Physics of the Natural World, and it's a perfectly fine course. And that is the one that I do believe was listed in terms of the title and the description when you registered. Does that sound familiar? All right. It was listed as Physics 102, but it was called Physics of the Natural World, and it talked about doing it talks about, you know, trying to understand the physical world, Newton's laws, a little bit of relativity, a little bit of light, nature of matter, that kind of stuff. It's a fun course, and I can teach it if you want it. I mean, I don't know what the registrar will do. I actually found that in teaching I started a different course for two reasons, okay? I started Physics 102 in part because I had sold a book on... I had to write a book because I had sold one on multiple universes. So I thought, well, I should probably teach a course on it so that I can sort of combine the research with writing the book and doing my classes. The other thing was I thought it'd be a nice twist to Physics 100 to basically teach much of the same stuff but then put a multiple universe theme in the course for fun. And I also thought that might make the course a little bit more interesting more broadly to students when you talk about the multiverse. I mean, in a sense, that's a little bit of a... I mean, some people get pretty interested in it. So that was the idea. So the first time I taught the course, they goofed up and didn't have it listed in the cluster requirements. And the second time, which I guess is this time, they had it listed with the wrong description and wrong title. So whatever. I don't know what to say. So what I want to do is to describe for you the course that I was setting out to teach, and you know, you can see what you think. Here's a copy of the syllabus, and it can be used as a cluster requirement in exactly the same way Physics 100 could be. This semester, it is listed as Physics 102. It's just when you registered, they hadn't substituted the course description for Physics 100, unfortunately. So I would teach most of the same topics in a Physics 100 class, but in Physics 102, I put in a thread of multiple universes, and we'll talk about what that is in the course of today. The basic kinds of topics I taught, first of all, this is designed for non-science majors. Okay, so there will be very little mathematics and not a big stress on that. It will be primarily a reading course. But we will have exams, and I'll tell you how I'm trying to structure it to sort of emphasize more the reading piece of it as best I can. The kinds of topics we'll cover are some basic physics topics like motion and energy and gravitation, rotational motion, waves. But we're going to be doing all of that in the context of covering some of what I consider to be the neater topics in physics today. And in fact, it's really an incredibly exciting time in physics today. There's a convergence between our understanding of the very large and the large-scale structure of the universe and our understanding of the really small quantum structure of the universe. And so there's a lot to talk about. So basically, I'm going to couch a lot of basic physical concepts in a lot of these very, very fun things. Now, you really have a massive advantage over our standard physics students and physics majors, because there we just bore them with the details and we don't actually give them the big overview so much in our classes. It's sort of horrible how we do that. So sometimes I actually have a physics major who sneaks into this class just so they can hear about some of this other stuff, which is very cool. So we're going to mostly talk about the cool stuff, and we have to do some of the muck along the way in order to get there. Actually, a lot of this is also very beautiful. I mean, a lot of the standard basic physics, rotational motion and light and waves, is amazingly beautiful, and I hope I can paint some of that for you. But we'll talk about the nature of forces and what you mean by force and what are the fundamental forces of nature, the fundamental building blocks of matter and why we think they're fundamental. There is a paradigm that we have now called the standard model of particle physics, which actually... is incredibly powerful, and people have been trying for 40 years to observe something in nature that cannot be explained by that paradigm, by that theory, and they failed to do so. Thank you. And so it's a very powerful thing. We're going to spend a good bit of time on cosmology, which is the structure of the large scale and evolution of the large scale universe. And so things like the Big Bang and lots of strange and new pieces that have only really been discovered very recently that come into play or not discovered yet at all. A thing called dark matter, a thing called dark energy, which I don't even think I have on the list. Cosmological theories that I don't have up here called inflation, many others, the evidence for inflation, relativity in its different forms, the nature of stars, where they come from and how they exist and what they leave behind, black holes. We'll talk a bit about nuclear physics along the way and some of the society implications of that and what's important, why it works, why people care if Iran is why they would bother centrifuging uranium. I mean, you hear all this crap about centrifuges on the news, right? Why? Why is that important? And so, we'll talk about some of that. So, lots of different topics. In the end, we will also talk about 11 different literal concepts of a multi-universe reality, okay? And some of them are science-based, some are not. So one thing that I want to do while I'm talking, I would like you all to pass this around. I would like you not to pass it over somebody's toes, and I would like you to pass it carefully because it's a little bit heavy. But I would like you to just sort of pass it around. Last person gets to bring it back up to the front. So, two hands where you can.
Sorry.
That's okay. All right, so first thing I want to do is tell you a bit about the course. I'm passed out a syllabus. I think you should all have gotten email if you're formally registered in the class. You should be on Blackboard and should have gotten an email this morning. I would like you to check, if you haven't checked your email today, check, and if you didn't get an email from me, make sure that I know. I didn't put this up to read it, but basically just to point out that it may not be what you think you signed up for. So think about that. The kinds of things I'm going to talk about, I mean, I have several prongs, several particular things that I want to really hit in this class. One of them is the fundamental nature of science and what sets it apart from other endeavors of human knowledge. And, wrong one. I want to spend some time pointing out to you the human face of science, because it's very easy to lose sight of the fact that it's done by people and that they argue and they do a lot of politics, and it's not always clean, and sometimes they're just wrong. And there are important aspects to science that speaking to a class of primarily non-science majors, I really want you to understand what the strengths and weaknesses of science are. So we're going to spend some time talking about error analysis, or errors, not so much doing the analysis, but trying to get an appreciation of the fact science is built on measurements, and if you make a measurement, inherently within it there is some room for error. And this has to be taken into account if you're going to evaluate the significance of a result. And there are many, many examples that you hear about all the time that have big effects on society as a whole. For example, do cell phones cause cancer? For example. Well, that has to be determined by doing epidemiological study, looking at lots of people and their cell phone usage and trying to find a correlation between the cancer and the cell phone usage. Now, there is actually no physical mechanism for it to happen, and there is a point in this class where I'll explain why that is. I mean, that is a case of completely irresponsible science, people actually taking that seriously, for example. But if you were to take it seriously, okay, bad science, and take it seriously, it can cost billions of dollars because all of a sudden you're having to change how you do cell phones or try to screen the radiation. Everybody has to walk around with some big metal sheath around their head if they're going to use a cell phone or something stupid like that. So, you know, there are real implications that come from misunderstanding or not appreciating the fact that science can be actually really wrong sometimes. And then there are times when it's really right and people don't listen for the right reasons. I'm not here to make a case for global warming or against it, but there's an example where I know lots of scientists that feel pretty comfortable with what the science is saying and people aren't listening. Okay, so there are lots of real issues there. But do you believe it or not, that actually boils down to getting into the nitty-gritty and looking at the scientific data to decide. And then for every measurement that you make, you know, is it a good measurement or not? So you have to sort of evaluate it. Thank you. So the nature of science is going to be one of the things we're going to talk a lot about. Another thing that I want to talk about a good bit in this class is confronting human bias, because we sort of grow up very comfortable with the environment in which we find ourselves, but the universe is vastly richer than that. Things go much faster, things are much bigger, much smaller. A great deal of time, you know, back in history and to go forward, things get much hotter, much denser than you're used to. And it turns out that the universe as we know it is actually different in many of these regimes. And of course, it's very common for us to take what we're comfortable with and sort of try to extrapolate that into everything we do. And it turns out that you really can't do that so well. And a lot of the weirdness that we're going to talk about this semester, a lot of the things that have driven progress in modern physics for the last 100 years have come about from looking in regimes that we don't typically see, where things get really strange. Things that you take for granted actually don't work quite the same way you're used to. So we're going to talk a lot about things like that. Relativity and quantum mechanics in particular have driven. So we're going to confront human bias and look at what can be gained when we sort of try to toss that out the window. Another thing will be just basically I hope to paint for you the picture of the universe as we now see it. And the excitement in science and a lot of the fun topics and things, the basic physical laws as we understand them and why we believe it to be the way that it is. And it actually is extremely cool. I mean, physics sort of has this reputation at some level of being this boring, dry stuff, but I hope you'll agree by the time we're through with this that a lot of it is really amazingly cool. And this sort of goes with the confronting human bias theme. We're going to see things that will just, it really just can't be that way. The universe is a bit more Harry Potter-ish than you're sort of led to believe. So it's a little scary. But one of the great things I already mentioned is this convergence between our understanding of the large-scale structure and evolution of the universe and how it ties into the smallest distance scales at the quantum level and how things have evolved through time. So there's a lot of fun there. So that's certainly a big theme of the course. And then, as I said, I'm going to have... these are all sort of themes of the course, but I'm going to basically have a thread in the course which is talking about multiple universe reality and what I mean by that and what are the different types. So that's going to be sort of the thread that I'll use to tie things together as we move around. Now, part of the problem with this and why I can't actually just do this, if you had signed up for a course on the multiverse, I would be apologizing to you for the fact that for a lot of the course, we won't be talking about the multiverse because it actually requires some basic idea of what we mean in cosmology and the evolution of the universe. So we have to work up some of this basic background of understand what we mean when we say quantum mechanics and what are the building blocks of nature and the forces of nature and how things might have evolved before we can actually talk about having multiple universes and the such. So. Anyway, I'll try to make this as much of a thread as I can. All right, so now it is a class. My intent is to try to make it fun, not to be a real hard-ass class, but more of a fun class. That said, I'm hoping to actually teach you some stuff, and you need to put forth some effort in order to get there. We're going to have three exams, and you will have what I will call a recitation every week. The recitation is a two-hour meeting with a teaching assistant that I'll work with, and I will be assigning readings each week, which I would like you to do prior to the recitation. Then the recitation, and sometimes in class, we're going to hopefully talk a lot about the readings and get you guys talking. The reason I have to do it more in recitation than in here is because, it's sort of hard to do classic discussions and stuff when you have this many students. So in the recitations, the size will be roughly 10-ish, and so you should be able to talk about it. In addition, so basically, in the recitation, there'll be a set of discussion points, questions, and simple problems that I'll ask you to work through as a group. And the teaching assistant will be there to be a facilitator, but not to stand up and just do it for you. But I will, and this is sort of a rub, I've actually never done this before. I'm not big on attendance things. This class is a little bit different because there is no book on this, really. There is a textbook, which I hope is now listed for the class. And we will read pieces out of that, but we'll have a lot of readings from other places, including the book that I just wrote, which is coming out in March, which is more designed for this class. It's not a textbook, though, but it does actually cover all the stuff I want to cover. Hopefully in a way that you like. We'll see. It's not a hardcore physics textbook or anything like that. So I'm trying to stress more discussion and working with things, and in order to do that, what I'm doing is really asking that you go to recitation, okay? Because that's where you're going to be doing that. I also ask that you come to lecture because I can't send you to a textbook and say, well, read chapter 3. That's what we talked about. I might be able to send you to 5 or 7 different places. Yeah, that's what we talked about today. But, it's going to be... So what I will do is I will make audio recordings and post slides. So that will be on the web. So when or if you miss a class, then you can catch up that way. Also, at the end of this month, I have jury duty for a week, so we may or may not have class. But if we don't, I'll be posting explicit slides and audio files, so I'll ask you to go through it or give you a different assignment or something. So the way that I want to evaluate your grade is to say that 40% is recitation. And what do I mean by that? I'm going to ask the TAs I'm going to ask you to help out by basically making a name card when you get to your recitation so that the TAs actually know who you are. And in time, that won't be necessary, but initially it will be. You're assigned, or when you signed up for the class, you have a recitation section already assigned to you. And please go to that. On the other hand, if you can't 1 week, it's fine if you go to another one. I'm going to ask the TAs to basically deal with whoever shows up, not so much just the people on that particular list. So if you have to miss the Monday one and that's your normal one, it's fine to go on Wednesday. If you miss Friday and that's the last one of the week, oh well, sorry. Try to anticipate that and go Wednesday if you can. I'm going to ask them to, for every person that shows up, to give me a number between 1 and 3. You get 0 if you don't show. 3 means you show some evidence of having actually read some of the stuff you're supposed to have read before you got in there, and you basically participate a bit in the discussion. Doesn't mean you have to have all the answers. Doesn't mean you have to be right, necessarily, right? It just means you have to be part of the discussion. A 1 means that you showed up, but you clearly hadn't thought about the stuff and you're not really participating. So you're there. You're a wallflower. You're writing down some of the stuff people say, but you just showed up. A 2 is somewhere in between, okay? You maybe don't participate so much, but you did show up some evidence of having actually done some work before you got there. Or you did nothing before you got there, but then you actually engaged during the time and thought about it and participated in the discussion. So that's the idea. So that means you have a possibility for each recitation of getting up to 3 points. We're going to have approximately 10 of them. I don't know whether it'll be 11 or 9. It'll be what it is. But you have potential for 3 points each one of those. That said, what I'm going to do at the end to get what goes into this, what gets factored by this 40% or multiplied by that 40% in the final grade calculation, is I'm going to take the fraction of 26 points. You could get up to 30 points. Let's say you blew off 2 of the recitations because you met somebody sweet and decided you wanted to stay up late. I mean, that's fine. Okay, I don't have any issue. I don't need to know why. I don't, in fact, probably even want to know why. But if you decide you want to blow it off, then blow it off, okay? You can blow off 2 of them with no penalty at all, is what I'm saying. So if you went to all the others, you blew off 2 of the recitations, you got full points on all the others, you would get a flat 100 that gets multiplied by the 0.4 here in the final calculation, okay? If you blew off a 3rd one, so that you're 9 points down, so you have 21 points, then I will give you a fraction, which is 21 over 24, whatever percentage that is, and that's what gets weighted by this 40%. So I'm giving you a free pass on 6 of the points. Now, it could be instead of blowing off a couple of recitations, those are the ones where you come in and you couldn't have read the stuff or whatever, okay? I'm not expecting everybody to get 100s on this, okay? I understand you've got other things to do or whatever. So I'm trying to build in some sort of... However, I am actually stressing it in a significant way here. Right? If you only go to half of them, this is going to start to really hurt you, okay? That's... So I am really asking that you go and participate in the recitations. It's an important part of the class. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, is there any questions about how we're doing that? Yeah.
Is it going to be a recitation today?
No, none this week. And in fact, not until I email you and let you know. I haven't decided about next week yet. Yep.
If you decide to go to one that we're not going, you don't normally go to, I guess we just have to...
You just let them know who you are. And I have no issue with that, yeah. No, there'll be 2 hours, and I've listed on the class website the 2-hour time slot. It is conceivable we'll slide it by half an hour one way or the other if there's a little bit of freedom to do that. I'm aiming for about 2 hours. We have the larger time slot because the 2-hour time slot doesn't fit within what the time slots the registrar normally uses, so we have to get 2 of those time slots, and it turns out to be the 2.5-hour window. So within that window, I mean, if everybody in your group wanted to slide at 15 minutes one way or the other, I don't care, but it's got to be good for everybody. Yep.
Good points off of being late to the recitation.
I mean, it depends on how late, but no. I mean, if you get there and you're engaged for enough of it, then it shouldn't. I mean, this is putting my TAs on the spot, too, a little bit, so work with me a little bit on this. I mean, don't hassle them too much, otherwise I'm going to find myself having to go just so that I can normalize the argument with the TAs that you're having or whatever. Yeah.
How are you going to decide the readings?
They will be posted on the web and or emailed to you. The vast majority of them will probably be on Blackboard because they'll be copyrighted material, so I have to keep them hidden from the rest of the world. But I mean, from you, you should be able to get in, just download it and read it. So there should be no issue with that. Yep.
So 26 points is the most you can get. Like 26 points is a legend.
Right. So if you go to the first 8 of them or whatever and you decide you don't want to go to the others, you could. Now the problem with that is what I'm hoping to design the exam so they're not really that hard. I mean, I have a really hard time making an exam that is stuff that's just what you've seen, just because it just tweaks me to do that. So I will almost certainly throw a little something on the exams that builds on stuff that you've seen but isn't quite what you've seen. So I'll do a little bit of that. But my expectation is that if you go and you engage in the recitation basically and do the readings and you follow what's going on, you should do quite well in the exams. Okay, that would be my intent in the design for the exam. That having said that, please understand that it isn't the mean for my exams is often around 65 for my formal classes. That's a good grade, okay, but here should be higher. But so don't get freaked if you feel like you missed some on the first exam. Wait till you see the mean and let me interpret it for you, because I tend to try to challenge people a little bit. So not every, you know, you're not going to have grades in the 90s too often. Yeah.
What if you get more than 26? Let's say you go through all of them.
Right. So if you get more than 26, then you should do better on the exams. I mean, that's basically what I'm saying. So if you blow off the couple, I mean, every time you blow off a recitation, you're going to be losing some discussion and practice of things which are going to show up on the exam. So it's a little bit of a double whammy there. So that's the idea.
But would the extra points be like extra credit or just doing
this? No, I mean, it will show up on the exam. I mean, I don't know how to cut you a break and then have that be a piece of it. That's not cutting you a break. In a sense. Yep.
The final exam is cumulative?
Yeah, it will be. The other two will not be. That's probably not as bad as it seems, because it's sort of the whole course sort of builds in terms of concepts a bit. The exams will be multiple choice and shortish essay questions mostly. There may be, I mean, we are going to do some quantitative stuff, but not a lot. And I won't tweak you real hard on the quantitative stuff. That I promise. Anything else? All right, so a couple of fine points. Let's see. I always, because the way I have this set up, again, it could be because of a family emergency, it could be because you made a new girlfriend or boyfriend, but whatever reason it is, if you decide you're blowing off one of the exams, the way the syllabus is structured, fine. I don't even need to know about it. Don't blow off two of them. But you could blow off this one or that one, and everything's okay. If you decide not to blow them off, then basically you're allowed a bad day and still do fine. So what I'm going to do is calculate your grade with these three different weighting schemes. Okay? And I'll give you the one that gives you the highest grade. And that will be what goes into the final numerical average. All right? So we have that built in. Because I allow this, I have to have something which I call sort of an inter-exam normalization, or at least potentially. So imagine that we have two of you. One of you had a grandparent die for exam one and missed it. The other one, you know, made a new girlfriend and blew off exam two. All right. And let's suppose that I have a really bad day making this exam out, and I'm a nice guy on this one, right? If this mean is really low because I just gave you a hard exam, and this one's really high, then it doesn't really work that it's equivalent to have had something that caused you to miss exam one versus exam two. So I can't have, in order for this to work out fairly, all three exams need to be roughly the same difficulty. And then it works fine. Then it's fair because it doesn't matter which one you miss. I will try to do that. Hopefully it won't be so bad. And I'm usually pretty good at that. But once in a while, it doesn't happen that way. And so I have to build in this. And so what I mean by that is, if this mean is really high and, you know, and this mean is really low, I'm going to actually scale all of your exam grades by to the same number. I'm basically going to scale the mean of this one up to like 75 and this one down to 75 or whatever it is. And so I'm going to scale all of your grades so that it moves the means to be the same. So I will not be changing your relative position within each exam, but if one exam is much harder than the other, I will scale the grades so that they have the same basic mean. You understand what I'm saying? Because this is a point at the end of the course. I'm trying to explain to you what I did. If I lowered one of your exam grades due to this, people get pissed off at me. I found people are okay if I raise them, but I don't know. All right. And the only reason for this, it really doesn't do anything other than just normalize the fairness between those two exams in case... So it doesn't matter which one you happen to miss if you miss one, which again is, you know, probably only a factor for a handful of you, but that's... All right. Right, so the other thing here is, you know, if I were really a great person, I would be able to scale the difficulty of the exams and set it up so that an A was like a 93 to 100 and a B was... I don't know how to do that. I mean, people who say they do, I don't even know how you do it. I can't figure that one out. The number of times I made an exam out that I thought wasn't too bad, and I realized it was really horrible because I did this or that. And, you know, after the fact, I can understand that. I don't know quite how to do it perfectly. I mean, as I've gotten older, I've gotten better. But because of that, basically what I say is I get the final curve, and then I put the letter grades on there because I don't know how to do it absolutely in advance. So it's a little bit of an apology, but... Okay, this is what I get paid for, so you just have to trust me on doing something reasonable there. All right, so no class this Monday, which somehow when I was setting up my calendar, I missed when I was actually making out the syllabus last night, and I finally got around to reading an email from Rich Feldman this morning and realized that we have no class this coming Monday because of Martin Luther King Day. So... in spite of what the syllabus says, don't show up here Monday. The other thing is no recitations till I send you an email. I need to get organized with TAs. We're not going to do anything this week. It could be that I'll start them next Wednesday. So we may start the cycle on Wednesday because of Martin Luther King Day. But I have to think a little bit about how I want to synchronize things. It may well be that I'm going to synchronize things by... asking you to do some readings and cover some material in lecture and then sort of talk about and do some of the stuff with that the following week in recitation. So if I choose to do that, I may delay recitations till week after next. So we'll see. I have to think my way through that. Okay, so my contact information is there. It's on the website that you should have gotten a link. Well, that's on the syllabus, actually. There is a link to the class website also on Blackboard, if you go to Blackboard. I know it annoys some students that I have the two sites, Blackboard and my own site. There are reasons for that. The stuff I put into Blackboard disappears in May. And if I'm teaching the course multiple times, I find that really annoying. I like to have it there so that I can use it. I also have complete control over the server in physics. So there are lots of things I like to do there, which are not so easy to do within the context of Blackboard. Blackboard, on the other hand, is the secure place for your grades and for copyrighted material. So it's the perfect place to do that. So unfortunately, that gives me the two sites. And so sorry if it's annoying. I have put a site, the link to the website, the class website on Blackboard. So if you go to Blackboard, you can find that and then move to the class website. So hopefully that won't be too bad for you. There are office hours that are on the syllabus. I forget when they are. Let's hope I don't the rest of the semester. I think they're on my calendar, so I should be good with that. They're like a good idea. It is my intent to be in my office during those hours, and you're free to stop by, and you take priority if you do during that time. That said, I may travel some. I know the couple hours I chose just may not work for you personally. So you're welcome to pop in whenever you want. If you pop in and I have something else going, I may have to make a time with you and meet you later. You're welcome to email me, and we'll set up a mutually a good time, right? So that's how the office hours work, pretty informal. So who are you? How many freshmen? Sophomores? Juniors? Seniors? All right. Any science majors? What area? Okay. All right. So what about humanities majors? Handful. What area? Okay.
Archaeology, technology, and historical structures.
Wow. All right. Yeah?
Something in humanities. I'm not exactly sure yet.
Fair enough. That's a common major. What else?
Psychology.
All right. Social sciences. What do we have here?
History.
History?
Political science. Economics.
Okay.
Economics.
All right. There were some others? Yeah?
History and policy.
All right. Good. Good, good, good. All right. Oh, class website. So that will be on. All right. Okay. So I was going to start talking about multiverses a little bit. Let's back off from that a little bit. What's a universe? One measly little simple single universe. So I don't know how to start talking about multiple ones of those unless I know what one of them is. So what do you think?
Collection of stuff in space.
Collection of stuff in space. Fair enough.
Matter and antimatter.
Could be made of matter and antimatter. It will have dimensions, whatever those are. We'll talk about them for sure.
Dark energy.
Is part of it, maybe.
And then just like existence.
Maybe you're getting closer, right? Yeah, so I hear a lot of things that I might consider to be part of a universe or a characteristic of a universe. It might have a dimensionality. It might have collections of stuff within it. It could include dark energy. What do you think?
It's a balance of various things, energy, masses.
Again, maybe characteristics, yes. It definitely has all these things sort of in a balance and an organization of some form. that's very specific, actually. Right? It is what it is. And it is what it is for our universe. Doesn't mean it's the only way it could be done, but it is what it is here. Yeah?
Would it be like a collection of matter that follows a common timeline or something like that?
A collection of matter that follows a common timeline. Yeah. That would it be... A universe would be part of... would could have that within it, for sure. It's a little bit like a collection of stuff. Yeah?
Well, I think to get to like the nitty-gritty of it, isn't it just someone's perception of what is? So like our universe is different than, let's say, aliens' universe from the fourth dimension to the fifth dimension. It's just our perception.
Okay, so... someone's perception of what is.
It's all about perception.
I see a hand up in the dark. Your dark matter, I guess.
So like the constraints of existence have to do with the perception. But the universe is like a constantly expanding thing. So it's kind of, it's more like an explosion of existence. So it's sort of
yeah, I agree. There is a boundary to what I would call our universe. Yeah?
Is it like the scaffolding or the rules that everything interacts with? Like, it's not the things that are in it, it's just, like, you know, it's the game.
That's a really interesting point. As to whether you call that sort of fundamental characteristics of a universe or whether you sort of claim that is the universe, that's an interesting thought. We'll actually be talking a lot about that, especially toward the end of the term. Yeah?
Doesn't universe literally mean one term?
I'm an ignorant science person. When you see the Latin words and stuff up there, you have to explain them to me. I won't even be able to pronounce them right, probably. The uni is definitely a one thing. So I think it is meant to be all-encompassing. That's for sure. One turn. I don't know how old the term is, actually.
I learned it from a religion class.
Yeah. I'm not sure why turn would be a piece of it. I was trying to think. I mean, there are pieces of what people thought were the universe that, in a sense, are, you could think about taking a turn around. I don't know. If I say, I'm the baddest ass in the universe, is there any badder ass than me?
Well,
we're not there yet. Trust me, there's no badder ass than me. All right. No, but the implication is I'm the baddest ass there is, right? There ain't another one that is relevant for us. You can't ever see one, feel one, smell one, or whatever. You can't get to it. It is outside of your experience. Forever. Right? That's sort of what I mean when I say the baddest ass in the universe, there is no better one, no worse one. I don't know how to say that. Right? Can you hear me in the back? Are we good? I mean, I can use the mic if I need to. Yeah.
We're good.
Okay. All right, so we have to define what we mean by the universe. And everybody is touching on it and has a lot to say about it, I think. But let me float what I'd like to use as a definition of a universe. I would like to consider a universe to be all that we could possibly ever directly experience. Anything that we could possibly have a causal connection to. So the universe, our universe is expanding. If you think about it, the speed of light is finite. It's really fast, but it's finite. And as you look away from Earth, you are looking at things, the light that you see left where it was produced longer and longer ago because it has to travel to your eyes. So as you look out into the universe, you're looking further and further back in time. Okay? And in fact, what that means is if you argue, and there are reasons to believe this, that we'll talk a lot about in the second half of this term, if you argue that our universe, as we know it, had a start, which we will call the Big Bang, perhaps there was something before the Big Bang, we'll talk a lot about that too, but if we have the Big Bang, right, then it basically means if it was 13.7 billion years ago, which we believe it was, and there are good reasons to believe this, then it means that we can only be causally connected to a sphere that has a radius of 13.7 billion light years. That is the distance that light could go in 13.7 billion years. Right? And that size of that sphere is expanding at the speed of light, but it is finite. Which means, and we believe, and there are good reasons to believe, as we'll talk about, that the universe's space is actually expanding. And it turns out that if that were the case, if the space is expanding, then the farther something is away from us, the faster it's moving away from us. It may sound a little crazy, and I'll show you, we'll talk at length about that. Maybe it's not, now isn't the time to really take care of that one. But if that's true, it turns out that as you go farther and farther away, the space that's out there is actually receding from us faster and faster. And in fact, it's receding faster than the speed of light. So that what we experience is actually becoming less with time, in a sense. There's a very much a finite part of the universe that we can possibly... There's a finite part of reality which we can experience. Perhaps that's all there is to reality, or perhaps reality is actually much bigger than that, but we can only experience this finite volume. If that were true, there are other finite volumes out there that we will never experience. And that's a multiverse. That's one form of one. All right? There are many other kinds, and as we'll see, but that's a form of a multiverse. So I'd like to define our universe, to be all that we could possibly actually experience, even through a measurement. So, you know, a microscope sees a bacterium, I consider the bacterium part of our experience, even though you may not notice it with your eyeball. But through our instruments and through whatever senses we have, it is what we can experience in a direct sense. Okay? That's what I consider a universe. Now, once we define that as a universe, then it allows us to talk about different possibilities for multiverses, of which one I just sort of mentioned to you. Anybody want to take that one on? You okay with that definition? Does it bother you, or? Okay. So we'll settle that as the universe for the moment. Okay. So One of the things I want to do right now, actually, so you get a sense that what the richness of the topic and why it interests me. Yes?
Just something about what you were just talking about. If something's moving fast in the speed of light, will someone see it in the future? From our, you know, from Earth or from anywhere else?
It violates causality. We'll talk about relativity, and it turns out that if you're sending a signal or something that you could interpret, if it moved faster than the speed of light, yeah, it can screw up causality and you can move into the future and things like that. That's not really what I mean. It turns out that space itself can expand faster than the speed of light, and it doesn't affect things like that. So we'll talk a bit about it. But no, that... causality is okay, in spite of the fact that we would perceive the edge of the universe to be receding from us, perhaps greater than the speed of light, because the expansion of the universe is the way it is. So I don't know. Well, ask me that as we move through the course. So, I mean, because we're going to build up a lot of pieces around that, I think. Okay. So what I'd like to do is introduce a couple of taxonomies of the multiverse, right? You know what a taxonomy is? Are you good with that? It's basically, yes?
Just a couple of questions. If I'm having a hard time reading the yellow box, can you slide
video? Oh, they'll be posted, and actually I'll be also giving you this paper to read that has it. Right now I'm just sort of painting pictures, so it's okay if you can't read it right now. Sorry. I'll give you a sense of it right now. There are basically two taxonomies that I know of. The one that has been out there for a while was done by this guy, Max Tegmark, who's a cosmologist at MIT. I did not say cosmetologist. Do you know what a cosmetologist is? Right. So a cosmologist studies the universe and the evolution of the universe, and a cosmetologist does your hair. Right? Astronomers study stars and galaxies and things. Astrologers, you know, tell you whether you're going to have a good day or not because of what you read in the newspaper. I don't know what they do. But all right, so don't confuse cosmetologist and cosmologist, even though his hair is pretty funky. All right, so Max has a taxonomy that basically categorizes different types of multiverses based on the level of abstraction, in a sense, mathematical abstraction in particular. I'm going to give a one-sentence description of each of his four categories, and I can't really do that cleanly because if you want to, I mean, in the end, this whole course is about understanding what these are. So it's not like it should make a whole lot of sense, probably, but I sort of feel a bit obligated to tell you a little bit. Regions beyond our cosmic horizon. This is Max Tegmark's level one multiverse, and it, in fact, is just like the one that I just told you about, where we can, because of the expansion of the universe and the finite speed of light, there's only a finite part of reality that we can experience. And so if you have evidence, or if you believe that reality is bigger than that, then there are parts of reality that are just causally disconnected from us forever. And so we consider, if you consider those as different universes, then that would be Max Tegmark's level one universe. The level two universe is called, I will call it the bubble universe. He's calling it a sort of other post-inflation bubbles. So this is going to sound a little bit wacky. Again, we're going to talk at length about this. There are compelling reasons to believe that the universe started out very, very tiny, and that over an extraordinarily short time, it underwent a massively exponential superluminal expansion right at the start, from about 10 to the minus 40 some seconds after the beginning of whatever it was that became us, to about 10 to the minus 35, right? That's a point 34 zeros and a 35, right? I mean, 34 zeros and a 1. Very small number. The universe, whatever was there, expanded really fast, much faster than the speed of light. We call this period inflation. It may sound completely wacky, but there are legitimate, well-supported scientific ways in which you can imbue space-time with this sort of ability to do this. Okay, fortunately, it's not happening right here, right now, but you can sort of come up with a scheme for this to happen. As this happens, there are places within it where quantum effects can happen and cause the expansion to slow down. And there you will get the seed of what we think of as a universe like the one that we're in. And so you get this picture of this inflating matrix with universes sort of popping up from place to place. And it turns out that the things that cause the characteristics of our universe to be the way they are, the masses of the particles, the nature of the forces, the dimensionality of the space, these things can be dictated right at that at the time that the quantum fluctuation that causes things to slow down happens, and it can be different from place to place. So in this weird bubble multiverse, you can actually have different universes, and they can be really different. They can have different particles. They can have different forces. They can have the dimensionality of space be different. So it's a very strange business. Each of these bubbles might also be so bigger than what we could have for our finite, what we can experience. So you could have a level one multiverse, which is in each of these level two pieces, which together form this level two multiverse. So when we talk about a multiverse, it's not necessarily just a one type. It could be multiple types happening at once. Okay, so if that's not weird enough, in quantum mechanics, is very strange stuff, and we're going to have a lot of fun talking about it. Quantum mechanics is a branch of science which we can use to describe, in particular, things that are very small. It's a little bit odd business, though. In normal physics, if you were to take physics 113, God forbid, you learn mostly what we call Newtonian mechanics. And in Newtonian mechanics, we study things that are called Newton's laws. We'll probably mention them a bit in here. Basically, though, it analyzes how things will move under the under a force, how the velocity and acceleration of things will change. So if I decide I want to lob a grenade over there or something, I can say how fast it's moving and at what angle, and I can calculate exactly where it'll hit. Okay, so this is known as Newtonian physics. And in Newtonian physics, if I set the initial conditions and I give you the information of how things are moving and what the forces are, you can predict the future. You can calculate exactly as it is. Quantum mechanics is very weird because it's also basically trying to figure out what's going on in the future, but it can only give you probabilities. So it's a very different business. And it turns out that there is a very elegant, and quantum mechanics works, okay? I mean, we'll talk at length why we believe this, but it really works scientifically. I mean, we can use it to calculate all sorts of wonderful things. And so it's a working theory. Now, what underlies that theory, it turns out there's an elegant interpretation of the mathematics that underlies quantum mechanics, which is a little bit odd, but it works. It basically says that if this process, whatever it is, okay, it could be an atom decaying or something like that, if it could decay this way or that way, whatever that means, it could decay, you know, there has a couple of possibilities how it might decay. In Newtonian physics, you basically say, well, it's going to either do this or it's going to do that, and I calculate whichever way it is. In quantum mechanics, it tells you only a probability, which in this weird mathematics that underlies it, it basically says, well, both this and that happen. And within the space that we calculate, the quantum mechanics calculations, we call it Hilbert space, so it's a little bit different from just three-dimensional space. They both happen, and the universe takes off in two different ways. In one, this happened, and in one, that happened. And so in quantum mechanics, anything that could happen sort of continues to happen, but we find ourselves confined to one possibility at any given time. And so you have basically this mathematics where you have an infinite number of threads of reality happening all at once. You can share the same space and everything, but we can't perceive it. It's very weird. It's called the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. And, you know, if you see a Star Trek episode called Parallel Universes or whatever, that's sort of what it's loosely based on, this sort of idea. So we're going to talk at length about that. Pretty strange stuff. Then we have Max's level 4. So that would be Max's level 3. Level 4 is a little bit even more bizarre. In level 4, what Max says is if you believe there is a theory of everything, so let me ask, do you believe there's a theory of everything? In principle. I mean, most physics geeks, you know, if you ask them, they'll probably, I mean, you might have to hit them with a shot of tequila or something, but they'll eventually sort of come around and say, yeah, probably, because they sort of wouldn't do what they do if they didn't believe there was some theory of everything, because they're sort of closet megalomaniacs and they want to understand the universe, and so the whole idea is to sort of get at this whole theory of everything. That's a little bit the mentality. They're not all that way, but... A theory of everything. A theory that describes the forces, the particles, the evolution of the space as we know it, the quantum mechanics that makes us tick, including the emergent phenomenon like life and stuff in principle. I mean, I'm not saying, do you believe we'll ever figure it out? But in principle, do you? Okay. So physicists tend to be a little bit more accepting of this because we're very deconstructionist, and we rip things apart and try to understand them at their simplest level. And if you deal with emergent phenomenon like life, I think it's a little bit harder to sort of accept that a little bit. Yes? Yeah. Do you believe that we could ever write down an equation that basically then really describes the laws of the universe?
But what if science couldn't explain the universe? Like, what if science is not an applicable way to understand the universe?
What are you doing? That's a good question. Okay, so I think we'll come back to that again and again. All right, so let's keep that one in mind. One thing I would say directly to that is, it may well be that science isn't the way to describe the universe ultimately, but it really works well for small bits, and that I think is a case I can make throughout this semester. I mean, basically, in fact, Max says it a slightly different way. There's a particular quote by a physicist named Wigner, and I forget, I'll pull it out for you when we talk more about this. Basically, it's saying, I'm amazed at the effectiveness of mathematics to describe reality. So the fact is, I can lob a ball and I can calculate exactly where it'll hit. And it's a little bit strange that I could do that and actually it works so well. And there are instances where where the mathematical theory of physics and pieces of physics, you learn things that you could never have figured out without the mathematics there. So there's this strange effectiveness of mathematics to describe reality, and we've actually had that around for a long time. And the Pythagoreans basically thought of the universe as being, I mean, the ultimate thing was to have perfect shapes and stuff, so the planets move on spheres and things like that. So it's not an unusual or new idea to believe that mathematics is special in the universe and describes things. But what is true is that it actually does really work well. All of physics theories are based in on the core of mathematics, and one of the reasons is that mathematics is unambiguous. That's one of the reasons we use it. Another reason is that it's extremely powerful and allows us to see things that we couldn't normally see. One of which is an example I'll show you in a second. But what Max says is that if you believe there is a theory of everything, which I think many scientists actually do at core believe, then if it's a theory of everything, it has to be unambiguous and completely self-contained. It can't contain words that are open to interpretation. It can't contain English, because it's truly a theory of everything. It has to be something some aliens could discover as well, right? I mean, it has to have an independent existence outside of us, if you believe that. And if that's true, Max argues that it has to be based in mathematics. Now, some people believe we discover mathematical principles. Others believe that mathematics exists as sort of an independent thing, and we only discover these things. We don't make up the math, right? 2 + 2 = 4 is sort of this abstract thing that was always true, and humans came around and sort of figured out, oh, that's true. We didn't just make it up. Okay, you could imagine that it comes from us, but that's a different thing. What Max says is that mathematics has this sort of transcendent reality to it, and that we're just discovering these principles, but that it can be, you can construct mathematical theories that are completely self-contained and unambiguous in and of themselves. And he argues that if you're going to have a theory of everything, whatever that is, it's going to have to be a mathematical theory. There'll have to be a one-to-one correspondence between everything that happens in reality and some aspect of that mathematical theory. Otherwise, it couldn't be a theory of everything. So that's what he's arguing. And then he takes it one further step. He says, so I believe that there has to be some sort of mathematical thing that describes the universe, if we have a theory of everything. But we can have certainly lots of different possible mathematical theories that are self-contained. So what makes that one particularly special? So he then argues, well, there is this thing called isomorphism in mathematics. And if you have a mathematical major, just if you're at a party, sort of slip in that word. Oh, that's isomorphic to this. And just look at their eyes. They'll get all excited. So isomorphism basically is a fancy word about it says there's a one-to-one mapping between something here and something here, okay? And so it's like if you fill the stadium, there's a one-to-one mapping between seats in the stadium and butts, right? Well, okay, you might have a couple of really friendly people, but other than that. So in mathematics, if you have two things that are isomorphic to one another, they basically are the same thing. So mathematically, what Max is saying is that our universe is mathematics. And if that's true, any given mathematical theory, we can have all sorts of different forms of those that are self-consistent. So he argues that our universe is only one of an infinite number of possibilities which are structured, different mathematical structures, and there's a one-to-one correspondence between these. That's a pretty wacky idea. It's way out there. But it is even more abstract, and it includes all these other possibilities, including a universe where there might be a god or something, right? Because, it's all possibilities. So it's a pretty bizarre idea. We call that I call it the mathematical multiverse. He calls it level 4. Okay. What I'm going to do in a week is talk about a little bit more of a down-to-earth taxonomy. I'll probably also post a reading that describes it before then, so we'll go through it. But what I want to do right now is to bring up another topic just to sort of end the class. What'd you think of that? Of this?
Is it gold?
Say what?
Is it gold?
Yeah, it is. I have 15 guys with Uzis stationed all around the room. At the current price of gold, we could certainly buy the university with a brick that size. It is lead, actually, not gold.
Is it a mole of lead?
It's just a brick of lead. I don't know if it's a mole of lead or not, but what crossed your mind when someone handed it to you? Freaking heavy, yeah. I mean, did it surprise you? Why?
It's the most common thing that science is a brick.
Yeah. You sort of are expecting a brick-like thing. And it's a lot heavier than a brick. Okay? So, it just sort of, you know, we have very strong preconceived notions about the universe. And the universe doesn't necessarily pay any attention to that, other than the fact that normally you don't go around running around with lead bricks, but there are lead bricks, okay? So if you want to understand the universe, you have to understand lead bricks. And things get, you know, a little bit weird. Here's a bicycle wheel, okay? And you notice, of course, if I have this bicycle wheel and I just support it on one side, it falls. Okay? You okay with that? That makes complete sense, right? Same bicycle wheel, but I'm going to spin it up. Same bicycle wheel now doing nothing but rotating very fast. Oops, not good. Is that weird or what? Okay? It's called precession. It's not even strange quantum mechanics or anything. So the universe is a lot weirder than you may think when you look at it really closely. To understand that, that's one of those things that intuitively, I never get it. When you look at the mathematics, which we will not do, but when you look at the mathematics, it just pops right out. It's one of those amazing things where you look at it and go, holy crap, math is really powerful. It's a scary thing. At any rate, human bias can mislead you. So a lot of what we're doing in this class is looking very carefully at some things and what the implications are, and we'll see just how strange the universe really is. So, all right, I have to let you go. I think people are wanting to come in.